As the court is aware, this court demanded this case for the type of individualized sentencing required by the decision of Miller v. Alabama. Despite this court's decision, the trial court below sentenced my client to 95 to 110 years and failed to identify a single penological purpose that justifies that sentence. Failed to indicate, make a comment, make a finding about how his youth or the special circumstances of his youth affected his culpability or any other relevant sentencing consideration. In doing so, the trial court made statements indicating that it was reluctant or unwilling to engage the individualized sentencing process required by Miller. And finally, the trial court relied upon a very prejudicial fact, the notion that my client fired the gun that caused the death in arriving at its sentence, despite the fact that that fact has never been adjudicated. It's been denied under oath by my client. There's no finding by any court anywhere that finding is true.
Did your client admit several times that he did fire the gun?
He made an extrajudicial confession to adults that was unrecorded and uncounseled, Your Honor. If the interrogation proceeded as it did in 1993 today, the jury would be given an adverse inference instruction under 29-4504. He was cross-examined about that statement, and it didn't budge. And like all false confessions, Judge, it was inconsistent with the other evidence in the case. There were two eyewitnesses who testified, not for my client, but for the state. They were called by the state and given real favorable plea agreement in exchange for their testimony, and had my client fired a gun that killed anybody, they would have seen it. Because he was in the back of the van, he'd have to move past them, he would hear them talk about it, he would see them shoot him, and nobody testified to that fact. And the reason is because it was a false confession. It's certainly a disputed fact. It's not the kind of fact that can be relied upon to move a sentence all the way up the range to the almost as severe sentence as can be imposed against a juvenile.
Counsel, in this particular case, how do you define then meaningful opportunity at release?
Well, Judge, I heard you ask Mr. Riley that, and I think that's for the court to put a number on. What I would say about
What if the court puts, like, as Mr. Riley said, 60, then are you going to come back and say, that's not a meaningful opportunity? I mean, what do you think it is?
Judge, I just don't think it's for me to take a position on that. What I think is
You're taking a position that, in all due respect, you're taking a position that 96 isn't, so I assume you mean it's lower than that.
Of course it's lower.
Okay.
And, if you look at the life expectancy tables where you just follow common sense, engage normal judicial notice procedures, he's got to be eligible for parole earlier than 64. And he has to be eligible for release earlier than 71. Remember, this court has held, I think, in State versus Hyen and other cases, that parole is punishment. It's not like registering, as Judge Stacy addressed recently in Bochy. It's punishment. And under the sentence imposed against Mr. Mantich, he's being punished until he's 71 years old. I want to be clear about Judge Stur's reasoning when it comes to this idea that my client fired the gun. First, as I indicated, it was an uncounseled, unrecorded confession. Second, Judge Stur seemed to rely on the idea that Judge Funk found that he fired the gun, but that's not true either. The furthest Judge Mullen went was to say that the confession strongly suggested that's true, but he also said everybody wants to know and nobody does know who fired the gun. So even Judge Mullen was uncertain. And don't forget, of course, that he made those comments. They weren't relevant to any legal issue. They weren't relied upon to determine anything. They may very well have been made simply to provide some solace or retribution to the victim's family, who undoubtedly were present in the courtroom. He was imposing a mandatory sentence. His comments didn't mean anything. So for Judge Durr to rely upon them, I think, is trouble. I think that the Graham argument about de facto life sentences is a good one, But I think that the importance of Judge Durr's reasoning is magnified when you look at the disproportionality and the due process arguments that are contained in my brief. And that's because of this. In my view, the most important point I could ask the court to consider today, maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong, but I think the most important point is this. If, as Mr. Mantich testified under oath, his offense conduct was limited to verbal encouragement of a robbery, and verbal encouragement that anticipated the victim surviving. Remember, he was saying something about Bloods. They all were. He joined his peer group. Said things about Bloods. The idea being that if the victim survived, he wouldn't be able to identify the participants of the offense. If his conduct was so limited, the state cannot credibly defend this sentence under the Eighth Amendment, especially in the absence of any facts or any findings supporting an inference that he's incorrigible or one of the worst offenders. The uncontroverted evidence is the opposite, that he's redeemed, that it was impulsive, that he grew up in a troubled environment, his brother was a gang member, he got into the gang, was in for a year, maybe 2 years, tried to get out, was chased at gunpoint when he tried to get out. If his offense conduct is so limited, there's no way that we can justify under the Eighth Amendment the sentence imposed, because it's at the very top of the range, up against or across the boundaries of the Eighth Amendment. With all due respect, the first question to the state's attorney in this case should be, can you defend this sentence, if that's all Mr. Mantich
said? Well, you argue in your brief, I think, that felony murder is a non-homicide. Where do you get authority for that?
The authority principally comes, Judge, from the very same reasoning that the concurring opinion in Miller provides from Judge Breyer and joined by Sotomayor. And that is that there's no finding, and no finding by anybody ever, that he killed or attempted to kill. And that goes back to what I said about if his offense conduct was limited to verbally encouraging the robbery, that doesn't even reflect an intent to kill or an anticipation that death would result.
He testified he didn't. He's not the shooter.
Correct. And the two other kids, younger kids, that were present in the van testified they didn't see him shoot anybody.
And did he tell other people he shot him?
While he was drunk and high the night of the offense, he came back to some friend's house who he had asked to go to the party, and he made statements to them. There's evidence in the record that those statements weren't consistent with what the Dillies, they weren't consistent with what they observed. They didn't believe him. He didn't have blood on him. He seemed not to be telling the truth in their opinion. But yes, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time unless there are further questions.
Thank you. Ms. Vinson, good morning again.
May it please the Court, Melissa Vincent, Assistant Attorney General, representing the Appalachian State of Nebraska. Some of the arguments I made are applicable here, except for purposes of the law, and I'm going to try to avoid its repetition.
Can you say what the state's position is, I want to say as a more global matter, on de facto life? Is that a proposition that this Court should be entertaining or adopting?
Well, I think that de facto life potentially becomes a problem if you have a non-homicide case. That's what a life sentence, but only if it's for a single homicide. And I know there's a split of authority on that as well. Some courts aggregate them, some do not. There's a case out of the Sixth Circuit from 2011, United States, I believe. They take the position that, hey, if it's more than one, you can go ahead and aggravate it. But to get back to your question, I think when you're talking about a homicide offense, or even if you have multiple offenses, which a homicide is one, and life without parole is an option, then I don't think that de facto life, I'm not sure that it comes into play in that scenario. I mean, you may still have to have your finding of your corruption, but I don't see that being an issue. And I would point you to a case that I cited in my brief, and I believe it was Garza, United States 2011, Pepperson, which is an Eighth Circuit case that was post-Montgomery. It was decided back in March of this year, and they actually declined. The defendant in that case was resentenced. He got a 600-month sentence, and he argued, made the de facto life argument there, and they said, we're not even going to consider it. It was a discretionary sentence, and so the question at this point is whether it was reasonable. They determined that it was, and they just declined to address the de facto life.
Well, we've acknowledged the debate, but we haven't been explicit at this court.
Yeah.
You make a comparison to Garza. Is there any proportionality review that you would make considering the fact that both defendants got basically the same sentence?
Both defendants, I'm sorry, which?
Well, Garza got 90 to 90, didn't he?
Yes.
And Mandich gets 90 to 90.
Right.
So that's the same sentence.
But the crimes
are a little bit different, aren't they?
Yeah, and I think they are a little bit different, but I don't think it's limited to that. If you look at what gets factored into a sentence, or various factors that can get rolled into a particular sentence, some of it has to do with the offender's background, maybe there are other circumstances that takes into account. So you could have two sentences, even though you have, like for example,
each case then is sentenced on its own individual facts, and you don't make any proportionality review to other sentences for first-degree murder of juveniles?
Well, if you can find sufficiently similar ones. Like, for example, if you want to contrast Mantich with Garza, Mantich was a gang member, and this was a gang-related crime. Garza, however, was not, and I'm not sure, Mantich had some history with the juvenile court, and Judge Mullen commented on that in the original proceedings, but I'm not sure that, I don't know what Garza had a very extensive. So there would be those kinds of differences. Might factor in. Obviously, Garza spent a lot more time with his victim. Some torture involved, so that sets it apart from, a murder like one in this case, which is horrible. But yet, there was really no. Well, I guess 3-4 minutes.
Is felony murder a homicide?
Yes, I believe felony murder is a homicide. As we argued in our brief, we believe that this court in Mantich 2 implicitly determined that felony murder was a homicide offense when declined to address Mantich's Graham claim and instead found his case was governed by Miller. And while I realize this court's opinion contains language suggesting that he raised a Graham claim after resentencing, I'm not sure I understand why. It struck me as odd that the court would remand Mantich's case for resentencing pursuant to Miller, leaving open the possibility that get a sentence life without parole. In fact, felony murder was a non-homicide for which life without parole was categorically prohibited. But having said that, as I understand Mantich's argument, he's advocating for a substantive limitation on the imposition of life without parole on juveniles convicted of felony murder complicit, meaning where the juvenile didn't actually kill or intend to kill. However, the only authority that he cites is the concurrence in Miller. But the position taken by the concurrence was not adopted by the majority in that case. Rather, the majority determined the defendant's level of participation in the offense was simply a factor to be considered in determining whether a sentence of life without parole was appropriate. Furthermore, several state courts confronted with the same claim and rejected it. Justice Castle, in his dissent in Mantich 2, relying in part on cases reported in Arkansas. Wyoming Supreme Court rejected Fairclough, which is cited in the defendant's brief. And then just a couple of months ago, the California Court of Appeals rejected it in Blackwell. You can find it 207, Cal Report 3444. But in any event, we submit that Graham has no application here in this case, since there is evidence that Mantich did in fact kill Hank Thompson. He confessed to the shooting not once, but twice. Furthermore, there were four other people present in the van when the shooting occurred, and not one of them came forward and said that Mantich wasn't the shooter. In addition, we have the comments of Judge Mullen, the original trial judge, who expressly rejected the notion that Mantich was a passive or unwitting participant in this offense, and further found that the offense was consistent with Mantich's character as reflected in his court records, and that the offense was, that the evidence strongly suggested Mantich, in fact, pulled the trigger. Consequently, Mantich was properly regarded as a shooter for sentencing purposes, which in turn rendered him eligible for life without parole. However, he did not receive life without parole. Like Garza, Mantis will be parole eligible at age 64, an age that several courts have found to be within a juvenile's natural life expectancy. Furthermore, it's clear that the district court intended his sentence to afford Mantis some years outside of prison, which is consistent with Montgomery. And to the extent that Mantis claims the district court failed to give sufficient weight to his youth in determining his sentence, we disagree. Neither Miller nor 28-105.02, and even Montgomery, requires the court to prescribe certain weight to certain mitigating factors. The primary purpose of individualized sentencing hearings is to take into account differences between offenses and offenders. Whether and to what extent mitigating factors are present will vary depending on the facts of each case. Thus, by necessity, it is left to the district court in its considered judgment to weigh the relevant sentencing factors and determine an appropriate sentence. Exactly what happened here. The district court expressly stated it considered all the evidence presented by Mantis and specifically considered Mantis's age as a mitigating factor. However, the court noted that age is one of the few mitigating factors in this case, and a review of the record supports that finding. Mantis began engaging in criminal behavior at the age of 12 and continued up until Thompson's murder when he was just 6 weeks shy of his 17th birthday. At the time of the murder, Mantis was a high school dropout, using drugs and alcohol on a regular basis, affiliated with the Lomas gang. This murder was gang-related, although Thompson was not involved in a gang. He just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. What began as a carjacking morphed into a kidnapping and robbery in which Thompson was taunted and terrorized for 30 to 40 minutes before being shot in the back of the head at point-blank range and then dumped on the street. As the district court correctly noted, this was a truly savage and senseless murder. Moreover, after Mantis was incarcerated, he accrued more than 120 misconduct reports and was involved in two violent episodes, one of which landed him in extreme segregation for 8 months. And although his behavior has improved in recent years, that fact alone does not negate other relevant sentencing considerations or render the sentence imposed by the district court at its discretion. In addition, it bears noting that the record contains some evidence indicating that Mantis could benefit from additional correctional treatment, specifically substance abuse treatment, which he is in need of, but as of yet has been unable to obtain. So all things considered, we believe the sentence in this case was appropriate, and unless the court has some questions from the judgment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? Minute and 39 seconds, Mr. Sipple.
Thank you, Judge. First, I apologize. I kind of sort of missed in response to your question about the authority for the idea that this case involves a homicide. The authority, the line was drawn in Inman versus Arizona, where they said that an adult can't be sentenced to capital punishment unless he killed or intended to kill. That's the worst punishment for an adult. Life without prison is the worst punishment that can be imposed on a child. The line is drawn the same in both cases. That's what Judge Breyer and Justice Sotomayor recognized in their concurring opinion. I want to say that I just want to, I think we should be real careful about continuing to talk about the idea that my client said something that Billy's into the interrogation. When you take that position, the position becomes that you are going to attach all the meaning in this case and make everything in this case depend on those facts. You're going to ignore everything else. You're going to ignore that he testified under oath that he didn't do it. You're going to ignore that Huerta and Carrera testified they didn't see him do it. You're going to ignore that no jury has ever found he did that. You're going to ignore that no judge has ever found he did that. You're going to ignore everything that ever happened in court. Witnesses, oaths, jurors, judges, lawyers, questions, findings. You're going to ignore all of that because there's some evidence that he said something out of court. And you just shouldn't do that. You're also going to ignore all the evidence at sentencing, which I think is, frankly, somewhat bold of her to suggest that the record doesn't support mitigating circumstances in this case. It's overwhelming. It's uncontroverted. Dr. Newring's uncontroverted. The prison official is uncontroverted. There's no evidence in this case that supports the notion that he's not redeemed or that his offense conduct was not the prototypically adolescent, impulse-driven, peer-affected conduct of a child. No. I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Up next, State versus Juan E. Castaneda. Mr. Riley, good morning again.